Namo Manjushriye, Namo Sushriye, Namo Uttamashriye Soham. O Namo Manjushriye, Namo Sushriye, Namo Uttamashriye Soham. O Namo Manjushriye, Namo Sushriye, Namo Uttamashriye Soham. Thank you. So, prayer book, page 73. And remembering, if this is new to you, it's always good to do prayers. I think to say to people who are not Buddhists, it's not a sneaky way of making you a Buddhist, you know. It's simply getting your mind into the right space. But for some people, it's uncomfortable. So basically, staying with a positive motivation is good. But if you're happy to do the prayers, we do so. To the Founder, the Endowed Transcendent Destroyer, the One Gone Beyond, the Foe Destroyer, the Completely Perfected, Fully Awakened Being, Perfect in Knowledge and in Good Conduct, Sugata, Knower of the World, Supreme Guide of Human Beings to be Tamed, Teacher of gods and human beings, to you, the completely and fully awakened one, the endowed transcendent destroyer, the glorious conqueror, the subduer from the Shakya clan, I prostrate, make offerings, and go for refuge. To the founder, the endowed transcendent destroyer, the one gone beyond, the foe destroyer, the completely perfected, fully awakened being, perfect in knowledge and in good conduct, Sugata, knower of the world, Supreme Guide of Human Beings to be Tamed, Teacher of Gods and Human Beings, to you, the completely and fully awakened one, the endowed transcendent destroyer, the glorious conqueror, the subduer from the Shakya clan, I prostrate, make offerings, and go for refuge. To the founder, the endowed transcendent destroyer, the one gone beyond, the foe destroyer, the completely perfected, fully awakened being, perfect in knowledge and in good conduct, Sugata, Knower of the world, supreme guide of human beings to be tamed, teacher of gods and human beings, to you, the completely and fully awakened one, the endowed transcendent destroyer, the glorious conqueror, the subduer from the Shakya clan, I prostrate, make offerings, and go for refuge. When, O Supreme, amongst humans you were born on this earth, you paced out seven strides, then said, I am supreme in this world. To you who were wise then, I prostrate. With pure bodies, formed supremely pure, wisdom ocean like a golden mountain, fame that blazes in the three worlds, winner of the best, Lord, to you I prostrate. With the supreme sides, face like spotless moon, color like gold, to you I prostrate. Dust free like you, the three worlds are not. Incomparably wise one, to you I prostrate. The Saviour having great compassion, the Founder having all understanding, the field of merit with qualities like a vast ocean, to you, the one gone to thusness, I prostrate. The purity that frees one from attachment, the virtue that frees one from the lower realms, the one path, the sublime pure reality, to the Dharma that pacifies, I prostrate. Those who are liberated and who also show the path to liberation, the holy field qualified with realizations, who are devoted to the moral precepts, to you, the sublime community intending virtue, I prostrate. Homage to the Supreme Buddha, homage to the Dharma refuge, homage to the great Sangha, to all three, every devout homage. To all worthy of respect, bowing with bodies as many as all realms, atoms in all aspects, With supreme faith, I pay homage. Do not commit any non-virtuous actions. Perform only perfect, virtuous actions. Subdue your mind thoroughly. This is the teaching of the Buddha. A star, a mirage, a flame of a lamp, an illusion, a drop of dew, a bubble, a dream, a flash of lightning, a cloud. See conditioned things as such. Through these merits, may sentient beings attain the rank of all-seeing, subdue the four faults, and be delivered from samsara's ocean, perturbed by the waves of aging, sickness, and death. Thank you. Good morning. I hope everybody had a good evening yesterday evening. I really miss being here full time. If I was able to join you all then, but if you had a good evening, be able to do some personal study, either along the lines I suggested or your own. And that hopefully you're beginning to sleep a bit better. Is that hopeful? I hope. Well, still we have that interference. Is that continuous?
Is it quite loud, Ben? Maybe?
A bit loud. I do worry it's me. Somehow I'm triggering it. I don't know. When I'm speaking, I don't hear it.
I'm sorry. I don't know how to fix it. We've had this.
Then it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. I just have to suck it up and focus more. That's fine. That's fine. No worries. Well, yesterday, we would look at some of the baseline understanding of mind. And from that baseline, then any study you make on mind will bear fruit. Often, I find if people go, quite a few times I've found people come to me and they've got problems. They're studying the mind at quite a high level, and that's very good. But the problem tends to be not what they're studying. It's they haven't got the baseline right. And so the error is often quite easy to correct, but it means them letting go of this higher level for a bit, going back to this baseline. And once they get that, they can go back to the higher level. So I say that because I think it's really important. So once you get this baseline, then you start to study the mind. I mean, you use this as a basis for studying the mind. And as I've said before, there are two main ways of studying the mind, two. One, the epistemological way. And the first one is really through psychology. What we're looking at through psychology really is what different minds, investigating the different kinds of minds, the environment around us that affect that mind, the circumstances and the effects that that produces. So you can imagine this is a very immediate study of the mind. It's a study which includes mental events, different types of mindsets. And it's asking us to really identify and work with the resultant results of all of this, the physical, mental, and verbal manifestations, and the habits and thought patterns we produce because of these different types of minds. And so, it's said in the Abhidharma, and the Abhidharma is a collection of texts which is all about really the psychology of the mind, the Abhidharma. And in the Abhidharma, it says that this journey through psychology is really a journey that's leading you from suffering and delusion to wisdom and peace. And that's quite a big claim, but it is claimed for the psychological study of the Dharma. In order to do that, then the focus of your study is what's called primary minds, sometimes called basic mind, sometimes called main mind, sometimes called root mind, depending which text you mean. But really, this is the primary mind. And if you think of the words basic, main mind, root mind, it kind of means the same thing. So it's studying those and studying what's called mental factors. And you're studying the primary and the mental factors in relation to wholesome and unwholesome mindsets. What are you seeking in the psychological study? You're seeking to understand our experience within this world. And it can be said that you can begin your spiritual journey here simply because this totally addresses the first noble truth of suffering. The second way of studying the mind is epistemological. So here, where the psychology of minds, what it does is it allows us to calm the mind. It allows us to begin transforming the mind. There is an immediate benefit to all sentient beings, not just yourself by purifying negative karma, but it paves the way to being of benefit to others as well. Now, when you go to epistemology, what you're looking at is a science that really deepens our understanding of the mind. It is really a refinement of our knowledge. It is a branch of philosophy, and it's really looking at the investigation, the processes, the origination of knowledge, the methods involved, the limits, the study of knowledge, examining the way the mind works, how the mind works. It's what we know and how we know it. So what type of journey in this? Well, in the Pramanana Sutras, which is where this epistemology comes into, they say it's a journey from ignorance to wisdom. This is the journey from ignorance to wisdom, where psychology is more the journey of from suffering and delusion towards wisdom and peace. This is more of a journey that's a wee bit more refined. It's going from ignorance to wisdom. But in some of the other commentaries on this, what I find more useful in thinking of this journey is going from conceptuality to direct perception. For me, that it kind of pinpoints it a bit more. It's more worthy of, I mean, who am I to say, but in my mind, it was kind of honed my mind into the real refinement of epistemology. What we're going to look at today is the psychology of mind. So Mary's going to hand out this crib sheet, really. Have a wee look at this. So it's this one with this list. Okay? So just spend a minute just looking at those headings, because in a nutshell, that is what psychology is studying. The first thing to say about this, the mind is so complex and it's capable of so much that actually the mind is both laboratory and our object. You're studying the mind with the mind. So here the question comes, basically, what is wholesome in positive minds? What is unwholesome in negative minds? And what is neutral and indifferent minds? Now, before we get down to the different mental states, really, The different mental states we're going to look at briefly, because you all know them really, but what they are, they're derivatives. The wholesome positive minds are derivatives of non-ignorance, non-attachment, non-aversion, the derivatives of that. And wholesome, unwholesome and negative minds really are the derivatives of ignorance, attachment and aversion. Because psychology of the mind, when you study it, it allows you immediately to start changing the mind, immediately to start purifying the mind, immediately calming the mind. Then it's good to just look at that and say, well, what type of minds are we looking at? So, I mean, this is dead simple, isn't it? I mean, what type of wholesome, positive minds could we be thinking of? What do you think? Maybe that's not fair because, I mean, we say types of mind, but for instance, love. Love is a type of mind. Would you say love was wholesome? Of course, of course, of course. So you're looking at compassion. You're looking at patience. In fact, you're looking at all the virtues. Why is this important? Change your mind to this. You have to get used, habituate yourself with these mindsets. Why? Because these, the Abhidharma tells you that these mindsets are the root of freedom. They are the root of freedom. Our principal motivation as a human being, unless you're very, very, very highly evolved, all of us, our principal motivation is to be happy and not to suffer. Because that's our principal motivations, we need to understand the different types of mind, not just understand them intellectually, but transform them into our heart and use that as the basis of how we enact in the environment. So we need to recognize these different types of mindset. We need to work with them. We need to examine them very closely, very closely. And ask yourself, are these the true causes of happiness or unhappiness? Examine them. You need to come to some sort of conclusion. And when you come to that end of conclusion, your job really is to discard or cultivate the different mental states. So intellectually, this sounds, well, yeah, duh. It's like teaching me to suck eggs. I know that. Of course you know that. But we're looking at transformation here. We're looking now, if you look at unwholesome, negative minds, tricky. I think I mentioned before the Tibetan Buddhism in particular is very keen on definitions, very keen on definitions, extremely keen on lists, very, very keen on lists. So when we're looking at unwholesome and negative mindsets, we tend to think generally, not in the Abhidharma, and certainly not in Tibetan Buddhism. So what you're looking at here is unwholesome minds, negative minds that are split into what's called six root unwholesome minds and 20 secondary unwholesome minds. Luckily for you, we're not doing that today. You just need to know it in order to study, okay? So generally speaking, what type of mindsets would we have which would be seen as unwholesome? You're on your own. Don't make me point the mouse. Don't make me, because I will. I'll tell you, I'll point the mouse. I will. Mary.
Anger.
Anger. Yeah. Why is that unwholesome?
It's destructive.
Extremely destructive. It's said in the Abhidharma that one of the biggest poisons and the biggest destructor of all mental states is anger. It is so powerful that unless you've dedicated the merit that you've gained, it's so powerful that it will wipe it out of existence. Now, it has to be pretty powerful to do that. Why do you think anger is as powerful as that? I mean, did they look at a whole list of unwholesome and go, jealousy, anger, I'll choose anger? No, no, no. There's a reason why they talk about anger being the most destructive. Why do you think that is?
Mind makes it more difficult to think, see things clearly.
Absolutely. Other things block, but this blocks it totally. This is like pulling a complete veil down on anything else. Yes? Anything else?
I think it's also underlying a lot of other emotions that we might then like jealousy or whatever else. So I think
yes.
It's more of a like a summary of a lot of other
yes. Anna, absolutely. And not only underlining, but as you say, it gives birth to loads of other negative states. It's almost like taking, like all bets are off. When anger is in your mind, all bets are off. Everybody gets it. Do you know what I mean? Not just the person in front of you, but the next person that speaks to you. It could be the person you love more than anyone else in the world, but they'll get it too. All bets are off with anger when you're behaving with anyone. Anything else?
It's really,
thank you, Mario.
Right?
Mario?
I think it's really the root. Anger, it's really the root.
It can be the root of all other delusions. It can be. It's certainly in behaving negatively. But I want you to consider this. When anger arises, and we've all been there, right? When anger arises, the sense of I is like a solid, concrete, immovable pillar. It really is. Your sense of I is so strong, nothing else gets a look in. And when your sense of I is really strong, then your aversion and your attachment is equally as strong. And all the negative things that it gives birth to are equally strong. If you've ever seen or you've ever been angry and you've looked in the mirror, your face is as ugly as sin. I don't care how beautiful you are. It's as ugly as sin. Imagine that your mind is exactly the same. Exactly the same. So the other type of negative minds, well, you know now, don't you? Attachment, greed, jealousy, possessiveness, any of these mind states are unwholesome. And again, you can say that, but you need to recognize, investigate, see if they're worth keeping, worth valuing. And we value negative states. Don't think we don't. Have you heard this before or used it? Yes, I was angry, but I was justified. Right? We say that. We say that. And we believe it. And we believe it. Because we think anger is valuable to a certain extent. And we think anger will protect us. And then we believe in second-hand anger. Have you heard this one? Well, I'm not angry for myself, but I'm really angry for others. So now we're getting angry, second-hand anger. What do people around you say? Quite right. Absolutely, I know where you're coming from. So you're validated in this concept. Acquired ignorance. There are many ways to validate someone else and to validate yourself, but not anger, poisonous. I remember being with Ben Rubina, and she was doing this whole session on anger. I don't know if you've had teachings from Ben Rubina, but I highly recommend it. Highly recommend it. And it was all on anger. And she was getting bombarded with questions about this and that and this and that. And she just went, stop. And she just said this. Listen to me, dears, she said. Anger is not getting what you want. No more and no less. You need to investigate all these examples you're giving me and hold it against the prism of not getting what I want. And then she said, then you can get back to me. Can I say for the rest of the weekend, nobody go back to her on it?
The great Shantideva said that what we do, what we wish for, what we want, I'm paraphrasing here, but what we want and what we do to achieve what we want are diametrically opposed. Due to innate ignorance, what we want and what we put the effort in to get what we want is diametrically opposed. We want happiness. And to paraphrase the great Shantideva, we run towards unhappiness. We want to be happy, but in trying to be happy, we only create the cause for suffering. Again, I draw your mind back to the five reasons we're still in bondage. One of them is mislabeling suffering situations as happiness. I'd like to just spend a few minutes on fear. Would you say fear is a wholesome or unwholesome mental state?
Unwholesome.
I would say so. Is there any chance it could be wholesome?
I think they are both.
Okay. From a Buddhist point of view, I mean, understanding how we are genetically programmed, a little bit of fear can draw you up and save you. Of course, it can save you. So that type of instant fight or flight, perhaps a type of fear induces, is very useful. Generally speaking, it's thought to be unwholesome. And here's what they say. Fear is really an unwholesome state because of infatuation. That's what they say. When fear arises, we're infatuated with it. We don't just say, oh, this is a dangerous situation, I'll get out of it, and then change your mindset to something else. We don't do that. We become infatuated with the fear. We begin to exaggerate the fear. We begin to think the fear is in and of itself inherently existent. And if that is inherently existent, then so am I. So the idea with this unwholesome state is this type of infatuation. It's not that momentary, oh, get out of the situation. Not like that. It's fear that makes you infatuated with it. The fear that's persistent. I have a fear of this. I have a fear of that. We know this, right? It's persistent. There's an infatuation here. Inappropriate attention spent on it. It's intrusive because it'll intrude on your different mindsets. It'll stop you doing a whole load of things. Also, when that fear is examined, we can see it's exaggerated. It's not putting fear down. It's taking away its power and not giving it power. So it's seen as an unwholesome thing. If you can think vividly, like what we don't want to happen in the future, if you can think about that, what don't we want to happen in the future? What do we tend to do here? It's a possibility that we tend to dwell on unhappy past events, hoping and wishing it doesn't happen in the future. It's kind of like a mental attempt to control a negative outcome for which you have no control over. Because of all this, fear is seen to be unwholesome, but not taking away the fact that we're genetically programmed to fear that which will harm us. And that is useful. You use it, you let it go, you go into a different mindset. That's not the fear I'm talking about. Any questions about that? Any thoughts, ideas, comments? Because fear is a biggie. It stops people traveling. It stops people eating certain foods stops people walking into a crowded. I mean, it really does. When you give it and you exaggerate it, it takes over. So we're giving fear control. Nonsense. It really is nonsense. But it's a habit, and often a strong fear is a habit over many lifetimes. Does that mean that it can't be changed? No. It's a mindset that's not intrinsic to the nature of your mind. It's a learned behavior. It came together through causes and conditions and can be dismantled the same way. But something to think about, no? So that's what you would be working with, something like that. So look at neutral and indifferent minds. Neutral minds. Any ideas what a neutral mind could be? We've got wholesome, unwholesome, but sometimes, and in fact, can I say it quite a lot of the times, we spend a lot of time not so much in wholesome or unwholesome, because we're nice people, right? There's a lot of times our mental states are kind of neutral. What type of mental states do you think could be labelled neutral?
What we describe as contentment?
That's interesting. Contentment. I think it could be. That seems reasonable. It would be dependent about what you're content about. Because if you're content about, for instance, something positive, I think that would be quite wholesome. If you were content about something unwholesome, then the same thing. But there is a mental state where you can literally just be, you know, just being there, here and there, now, nothing else really going on. Yeah, I would think that was kind of neutral. Definitely. Anything else? What about sleep? So sleep, of course. I'm not talking about dreaming now. I'll talk about more on that in karma. But just sleep. Could that be a neutral state? I think so. I think so. There's nothing, you know, you're sleeping, I'm not talking about dreaming now, but there's not a wholesome or unwholesome, so that can be kind of neutral. We spend a lot of our time standing up and sitting down. We spend a lot of our time walking. We spend a lot of our time eating. Yes? Could they be seen as neutral? Yeah, they could. Now, they could also be seen as wholesome. I mean, if you're getting up as, when I was teaching in prison, people were getting up to bash other people. That was not very neutral. That was very negative, really. But if you're getting up with the most people to help, then it's quite positive. But generally speaking, every time we get up, we get down, we go for a walk, we eat, it tends to be kind of neutral. Now, with wholesome, unwholesome, and neutral minds, one of the ways to work with that is because they're not intrinsic to the nature of clarity and knowing, they can be changed, they can be altered, and they can be dispensed with. Right? Because they came about through causes and conditions. You can get rid of them through causes and conditions, but you can also use them in order to transform the mind. So the idea would be recognizing unwholesome states as they arise, not when you're caught up in it. Very difficult then. Better to walk away if you're caught up in unwholesome thoughts. But if you can see and you can identify an unwholesome thought very early, then you can transform that thought. You transform it into something wholesome. Can anybody think of an example with that? Yes, Gabriel.
So if you were angry with someone and you could transform that into compassion towards them, saying things from their point of view?
Yes. Because immediately you recognize a mind state, you can change it. Most of us don't change mindset because we think it's normal. Why would I bother recognize that? I don't want to change it. That's just the way I am. Okay, cool. And there are many, within the Lam Rim, there are many ways that you could transform a negative mindset. Through compassion is one. Through loving kindness is another. You can transform it by bringing karma to mind. You can transform it by bringing precious human rebirth. Why am I wasting my precious human rebirth? I'm getting angry with this individual. What a waste of time. You could transform it by understanding the nature of reality. There is no I. You get angry. There is no inherent existing I, self, within this individual to be angry with. What nonsense is this? So you can use your understanding of the Lam Rim, any of these topics, to help you transform your mind. Now, within Lam Rim teachings, they are very specific. They'll say, if you want to do this, use compassion. If you want to change this type of mind, use this. And initially, that could be useful. But personally, what I find, and this is just what I find, depending what I'm studying, depending what I'm reasoning, I'm reading, that is what I use to transform a negative mind. They say the two of the best to transform anything is understand emptiness. You see the emptiness of it, or the compassion. Both of those that are seen as prime. What I find, personally, and you'll find your own way through this, is that, well, yes, that's true, but I tend to be very influenced by what I've been reading, what I've been studying, what I've been preparing for. I've been teaching 8 verses of thought transformation at Liverpool. So my mind is full of these 8 verses. So if somebody asks me something, like say something so I can tell the mic, without thinking, I'll just say one of the verses of the 8 thought transformation. If something happens and I get a bit annoyed about this, like, well, there's a few things, because, you know, it's just the way it is. Then what comes into my mind? One of the 8 verses. Immediately calming the mind. So the more you understand the Lam Rim, what you have is you have a doctor's bag of full of antidotes to that which is unhealthy, that which causes suffering. Oh, sorry, Bina, yes?
Morning, Mary. Can I just check? You know, these wholesome minds that we can cultivate in Lam Rim, such as loving kindness and compassion, are those minds different from the nature of the, or from Buddha nature and the qualities of Buddha nature?
Yes. But what they do, if you're developing compassion, is the compassion you're developing the same as the compassion within Buddha nature? No. That's far better. But here's what it's like. It's like going outside on a sunny day, right? You don't know which direction you're at, and you want to face the sun. So you find a sunbeam, and you follow that sunbeam, and there is a sun, right? These things we are developing are like the sunbeams. They're a reflection of your Buddha nature. They're not your Buddha nature, but they're a reflection. Follow that, deepen that, and you get there. Yes, you're welcome. Okay, so it is said that neutral minds are very useful to recognize quite early on. You can recognize wholesome and unwholesome pretty quickly. You just have to recognize they're important. Neutral minds, not so much. But neutral minds are ready. In the text, in the Abhidharma, they discuss neutral minds as being like a white cloth, which then could take on any color that you dye it with. So very easy to turn a neutral mind into, say, an unwholesome mind. Quite easy to turn a neutral mind into a wholesome mind. What do you think helps to change a neutral mind into an unwholesome mind? What would it take?
I was just going to ask on that, because like when you said, for example, walking or particularly eating, being neutral. So
it can be neutral. If you eat with greed, it's not neutral. If you eat with attachment, it's not. But generally speaking.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking. So, you know, if you say walk and you thoroughly enjoy walking, is that then showing that you've got an attachment which would make it more negative? Or is it just that you can see the pleasure, even if it's kind of raining or whatever, and it makes it a positive thing? Or if you enjoy the food, you know, does that mean you've got attachment, or is it positive?
You see, you've answered your own question, Anna, very clearly. Because is there anything wrong with joy? No. Personally, I'd rather be happy than unhappy. And I like joyous states. I'm sorry, life is hard enough. So what we're looking at is joy without attachment. Joy without craving. Joy that doesn't say, if I can't walk tomorrow in the same way, I won't be happy. It's just not good enough. It's joy without expecting that same level the next time you go for a walk. In that moment, mere enjoyment of what you're doing, that can be very, very helpful because it calms the mind. If you do it with attachment, not so good. Pure joy, wonderful. So how could you transform going for a walk then into a whole? Because I'm not saying joy is wholesome. What I'm saying is joy is a nice state to be in. And it really depends what's causing the joy. Okay? So it's still not very strong, is it? So how could you turn going for a walk into a strong, positive, wholesome mind? This is a general question, not just for Anna. Mary?
Intention.
Yes.
To benefit others.
Yeah. So when you're going for a walk, you before you go for a walk, you set your mind. You're not just doing it for self-pleasure. If it's possible, you're going to do this walk. Let's say there's 1,000 things you could intend. You could say, you could make the intention to be healthy. To be healthy and happy, so that when I meet the next person, I'm meeting them with a healthy, happy attitude. If you meet someone that's miserable, they don't want to speak to you. They're not going to ask you for help. But if you meet someone that is healthy looking, that someone who is happy, not hysterical, but just happy, they draw people like magnets. And if you draw people like magnets, you can help. What's another intention you can? That's only one way. What about another way? You could set an intention now for going for a walk. Let's say you're going for a walk this afternoon. What other intention could you set?
To use it as a walking meditation on something different.
Yes, perfect. Especially if you know how to do a walking meditation, and even if you don't, you can walk mindfully. There's different types of walking meditation, but yeah, perfect. Perfect. How else? You're only limited here, by the way, by your imagination. By your imagination informed by Lam Rim. How else could you form a positive intention? Well, I'll tell you Lama Zopa's way, or one of Lama Zopa's way. That's the intention. As I walk this path, may I walk the path of the Lam Rim. I know my goal is to reach the kitchen, but may my goal be enlightenment to benefit all sentient beings without exception. Only limited by your imagination, informed by the Lam Rim. Then, what about going to sleep? How could you turn a neutral mind of going to sleep into an unhealthy mind? Remember, I'm saying going to sleep. Well, if you're reviewing the day and you're reviewing in a negative way towards other people, towards other circumstances, towards other event. If you go to bed with a mind that's kind of negative, it bleeds into the sleep. Now, it's not huge negative, okay? It's not huge because of reasons we'll talk about with karma, but it is not wholesome. And if you know what it's like, if you go to bed happy, you're going to bed with a good mindset. If you go to bed unhappy or with any poor mindset, then sleep itself can be almost, you almost bleed into it. But let's say our purpose is to turn our neutral into a positive thing. How could you turn the mind of sleep into a positive mindset? The act of going to sleep into a positive mindset.
I think you could apply the healthy sort of idea again and say that sleep is going to be restorative for you to be healthy and well rested the next day to benefit others.
Yes, perfect. Yeah. Then go to sleep. Perfect. But how else could you do it? I'm not sure you can best that personally, but there are other ways. How else could you do it? Turning the act of going into sleep into a wholesome mind. But there are others. I'll let you think about it. But personally, the way Anna said it is kind of, it's hard to beat that, really. So here's why we're looking at wholesome, unwholesome, neutral minds. Unwholesome minds can be transformed into wholesome. You just have to recognize them, have some understanding, Lambren, and do it. Neutral minds are ready. It's easy if you're doing something neutral for it to turn negative. Very easy. Very easy for something neutral to turn negative. It takes a bit of effort for something neutral to turn wholesome. Not much effort, really, but some effort. So any thoughts, ideas, or comments on this aspect? Wholesome, unwholesome, and neutral.
Is there a thought on whether it's easier to turn unwholesome thoughts into neutral or less unwholesome rather than straight into positive ones, but when it comes to mental effort into...
Yes, I think you can. I don't think they advise it. I think they always go for the best you can do, and the best you could do is to transform it into something positive. And if you have an unwholesome mind, it is negative. You already have it. Right? Unless you employ various karmic means, you can't get rid of that. It's there. But because one moment of mind gives rise to the next moment of mind and on, there's a chance that that unwholesome mind will continue. So you need to intervene. This is the best intervention. You need to intervene here. If you're going to intervene, then it's just as easy. If you can, if you know what you're doing, to transform it into something wholesome. However, let's say you don't, or you can't at that moment. It's just too powerful, because we've all had powerful negative emotions that just lead us by the nose one way or another. They just do. So how could you turn that type of thing, not making sure that the next moment is not the same as this, into something neutral? How could you do it? I'd like you to, oh yes, Dina.
Feeling angry,
yep.
I think you could transform that into something neutral by recognizing it and then taking yourself out of that situation, maybe going for a walk.
Yeah. Exactly. What you're talking about here in Dharma speak is to disassociate from it and do not give it inappropriate attention. And when we do, when we go further on today, I'll explain that a bit more. Not give it inappropriate attention. So disassociating and moving away from it. Not standing there going, and you see what happens if you're there, then you want to give yourself a reason why you're still angry, or you're still annoyed, or you're still jealous, or you're still greedy. You'll start to give yourself reasons, because I deserve it. Look what they did the last time. If I don't do this, who's going, you know, suddenly, one moment, this unhappy mind starts to justify itself. I'm not doing this on for me. I'm doing it for the people to come. This is what we say. Anger is never positive in any way, shape, or form. Never. It has one function, and one function only. That's to create delusion. That's all it does. It creates it, it feeds it, and it makes the eye so strong that it's hard to come out. It's like trying to get out of prison without a key. Very hard. Thank you. Anything else about these three mindsets? Okay. I'd like you to look now at these primary minds. We talked about six types of mind before, if you remember. There was the five sensory minds and this mental consciousness. But what we are looking at here is what these minds do. What does a main mind, a primary mind, a root mind, what is its function? Now remember, this mind is clarity and knowing and nothing else. Okay, remember that from yesterday. It's clarity and knowing and nothing else. The function of that mind, this primary mind, and by the way, all five sense minds are primary. It doesn't feel like that, but it is. But anyway, that's for a different time. Never mind that. Anyway, primary mind. It has a function. Its function is to apprehend the totality of any object. Its function is to apprehend the totality of an object. It is what you can call a primary cognition. A primary cognition. It's not static. It's very fluid. It's a fluid presence in all minds. But the primary mind is to apprehend the totality. This mind has no comment to make on any object. No comment. It does, it's merely conscious of the data that's presented to it, merely conscious of the data that's presented to it, a primary mind. Although it's fluid, because one moment gives rise to the next, it's always fluid, you could say that this is quite a passive mind. Not passive in being still, but passive in not have no interest in color, shape, form, attitude, nothing apart from the data that's presented to it, nothing. This primary mind. This primary mind is the basis now for mental factors. A primary mind does not arise alone. Not in our life, not for us. Doesn't arise alone. It arises with mental factors always. Always arises with mental factors. So once more, the primary minds, all the sense minds, and mental consciousness, as you know, can be perceptual. As well as, I don't need to go into that. Okay, so primary mind, minds of perception, all five senses of that. With the mental consciousness is both. It's both perceptual and conventional. This is something else you need to look up later on, but I'll go through it. So this primary mind, what's it interest? Is it movable? Yes, it's fluid. It's fluid presence in all mental states. It's there all the time. When described as passive, it doesn't mean it's still. It means that it's interested in nothing else. Nothing else. Right? It is the basis for mental factors. So if the primary mind is basically apprehends the totality of an object and is merely conscious of the data that's presented to it, then how does this mind work in thinking this is nice, this is not nice, oh, that's blue, that's pink, there's not enough light. How does the mind do this? Mental factors. So mental factors you've got down here 51, you can see that in practice. In reality, there are thousands of mental factors, thousands. But in the Abhidharma, just to give us a taste of lists, it allows us 51. But there's more, a lot more than that. Remember, when it comes to lists, the Tibetans are keen on lists simply because when you're learning the Dharma, broad overviews are not really what they're going for. They're going for, you're leading towards epistemology where you have to be quite exact. And so if you know there's 51 of something, you recognize each 51 and then you learn from it and you transform it or you get rid of it. Do you see what I mean? So that's why there's lists. It's not just to be pedantic. So mental factors. These mental factors are not passive as the primary mind is. Mental factors are very active, very, very active. Mental factors apprehend particular qualities of an object. So it's mental factors that are saying, well, this is like stainless steel. Yeah. And that's the stainless, and this is kind of brown and it's ridged and it's got a black top and it's got a flip. You know what I mean? That's mental factors doing that. Mental factors. Now, mental factors do more than that. Mental factors actually determine the quality of the primary mind. This is why they're important. They determine the quality of the primary mind. They determine the characteristic of the primary mind. Mental factors are what is responsible for selecting data. If you select it, the process of selecting data, this is mental factors doing this. Mental factors are responsible for the basic clarity and awareness of the primary mind. Now, if this is going over your head, please don't worry. Remember what I said right at the very beginning. Each one of these topics, I've done weeks. I've done a week on this, you know. What you're getting here is a taste, the basis, and a glimpse. If you want to go further in study, then fine. For many of you, you already know this, so it's kind of like a review. For some people, yes, very good. Do you see what I'm saying? Not to be worried about this. It's important, but you can go for a week on studying the mind. And even then you won't study at all, but it'll be more than this. Okay. So if mental factors are basically responsible for the clarity and awareness of the mind, they're also primarily responsible for all wholesome and unwholesome experiences. It is the mental factors that are responsible for them. And if you're being asked to transform unwholesome into wholesome, to trans to recognize and transform neutral into wholesome, then what does that? Mental factors. And so you study mental factors. Personally, I think it's better to study mental factors by yourself, because it's a list and it's definitions. And then once you know them, then come together and discuss with each other. But it's interesting. So these mental factors are really important. They color the mind. So of these 51, I'm just going to give you the list here, not the whole list. There's what's called five object ascertaining mental factors. I always thought it's a bit torturous. So I tend to call it, some of the books call it five always present mental factors. I like that. It's what it says on the tin. Do you know what I mean? Five always present mental factors. There are 11 wholesome mental factors. 11. Of course, there's many unwholesome. Of all the unwholesome mental factors, there are six root unwholesome mental factors. And there are 20 secondary unwholesome mental factors. This is something for self-study. I just want you to be aware. And there's also what's called four neutral or changeable mental factors. So what is it I want you to take out of today? Really, primary mind, fluid, underpins all your mental consciousness, but it is passive. It's only interested in the totality of the data presented to it. It is the mental factors that decide the quality of that mind. Taking that away, that's very good. Okay. So the next thing I want to say about mental factors is that mental factors are not separate. They're not something that's hanging around next to the primary mind, right? They're not separate from the primary mind. It's possible to say they arise from the primary mind, and because they're changeable, they can't be part of the primary mind, but they're not separate. So it's really to do with how you view it. So one of the ways that you're taught how to look at this is that, and we'll go into this a bit more when we do emptiness, the hand is not the body. The hand is not the body, but it is part of the body. Mental factors are not the primary mind, but in one way, they are part of the primary mind. They're not separate. They're part. Another way that the Abhidharma explains it is the primary mind is like a candle flame, So the flame is flickering. Mental factors are like the light rays that are coming from that flame. There's a link here, but it's not that distinct separate link that we normally live with, because we have this very much a duality of thinking. So mental factors, they're part of the primary mind, they're not separate. In the way that the hand is not the body, but it's not separate from the body either. In the way that, as the Abhidharma talks about it, the flame of a candle is like a primary mind, and the rays that come from it, a bit like the mental factors. So when you're studying it, maybe understand that, because some people do go away with the idea that you've got primary mind and then you've got these mental factors. Like this. It's not like that. If you're going to do further study on this, then I do recommend looking, taking on board everything we've done, and then maybe look at the difference between conceptual apprehension, of objects and phenomena versus perception, apprehension of objects. This will really enrich what we're talking about here. Definitely enriches it. So at this stage, what we're really looking at is mental factors, identifying them within ourselves. First of all, learning, and then identifying it within ourselves. See how they operate in our life. Then see how you can work with them and transform them, particularly unwholesome and neutral, into wholesome minds. The benefit is immediate. The benefit is immediate in a multitude of ways, and it goes well beyond being a nice person. It goes well beyond that. And His Holiness, remember, when he talks about mind, he says, when we talk about mind, we're talking really about a highly intricate network of different mental events and mental states. It's highly intricate. What I'd like to do now, if you're up for it, I'd like to do a meditation here. But the meditation I'd like to do is to guide you through the five always accompanying mental factors. The five. Why? Because these five, whenever you are cognizing anything, these five are always present. You're never always jealous. You never always are wise. You're never always all the other 51. You're never always that. However, what is always active with every moment of mind are these five always present mental factors. They have a function. Let's see what they do. So please, getting yourself into a really comfortable. Take a moment just to move around, just to loosen anything up that needs to be settled. Get your body in the right state. Bringing the mind inward. Relaxing on the out-breath. Letting your whole body hang like clothes on a clothes hanger. Just let it drop. On the in-breath, while maintaining a relaxation, whatever level, allow the mind to naturally brighten without any effort on each in-breath. Your motivation runs along the lines of, I want to meditate on these five always present mental factors. Because this is how my mind works. I want to find out how my mind works so that I can work with it in order to benefit myself and all living beings, without exception. The first of these always present mental factors, always present, is called contact. Its function is solely to meet the object. It directs the mind to meet the object. Contact. Remember, the primary mind is passive. Contact moves it. Well, better to say, really, that its function is solely to meet the object. The second mental factor always present is called discrimination, sometimes called discernment, but we'll say discrimination at the moment. The mental factor of discrimination. What do you think it does? Just think. Discrimination notes the characteristics and identifies the object. Notes the characteristics and identifies the object. So you could say it's the basis of memory. The third mental factor, which is always present, is feeling. This mental factor experiences the object as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. It experiences the effects of past actions. It can be the basis for craving. Feeling is one of the strongest aspects of any mind. And it mentally tastes the flavor of that object. Is it pleasant, unpleasant, neutral? The effects of past actions, the basis of craving, very, very strong, this mental factor, the strongest. The fourth always present mental factor with every moment of mind has various names. It's called intention, sometimes called volition, but we'll stick with intention. This is the principle of activity. You could say this is karma itself. Remember, karma is about action. Often people say karma is cause and result. No, it's not. It's cause, it's action. So intention is the principle of this activity. And you could say it's karma itself. It can direct the mind. And it can accumulate tendencies and imprints. It's the primary trigger for all actions of body, speech, and mind. Intention works at a deeper level than motivation. It has a little bit of the flavor of motivation, but it's deeper. It's the cause of all future happiness and unhappiness because it plants the seed of it. And the fifth always accompanying mental factor is called attention. Attention. And its function, always present, is to focus the primary mind on an object to the exclusion of other objects. It keeps the object before the mind. All of these could be positive or negative, but take attention. Attention, very positive, can be very positive. You need a highly developed faculty of attention if you're going to practice and develop meditational absorptive states such as shamatha and vipassana. You develop this to a fine level. However, it can be negative. You could be in a state where you're exaggerating what's going on, whether it's fear or anger or what or desire, and you're exaggerating that quality. The teacher will say, you're giving it inappropriate attention. Inappropriate attention. Let it go. Do not attend to it. Let it go. These are the always present mental factors. Good to learn these and then study the rest so that you can work with them. It can be that when you study the mind at a deep level, it can become quite intellectual. And there's nothing wrong. You need a good intellectual understanding of the mind, but that's only a step. The next step really is to be able to put it into practice to benefit yourself and others. So Kabji Lama Zopa says, whatever you're doing here, it's important for Buddhists to note that the very purpose of our life is to benefit other sentient beings. This is our ultimate spiritual goal in this life. Intellectual understanding has its place and it's necessary, but only because it leads to benefiting other sentient beings. Think about that. Come to some sort of positive conclusion in your mind. Let go of any internal dialogue. And just focus on your positive conclusion for a few minutes. Try to focus. So come to a conclusion. Could be anything, as long as it's positive. Let go of the mental discussion. And try to focus on your conclusion. The one object, your conclusion. If your mind wanders, just gently bring it back, revive the conclusion, focus. Thank you. So, I want to look now at Perfect Human Rebirth. I think the first thing I'll say about it is this. Sometimes we call it, and I tend to do this, I call it precious human rebirth. But it is better to say perfect. Because all human rebirth is precious, all of it. All sentient beings are precious. So there's no such thing as sentient beings who are precious and certain beings that are not precious. So it's a mistake. I tend to remember in my initial teachings and build on that, and the initial teachings they used with me was precious. And my habit is to go back to that. And then people think there's a difference. So perfect human rebirth, start now. That's the best way to think about it. Perfect human rebirth. We need to have the confidence. We need to have the courage. We need to know that we're capable of doing this. It is easier to follow habits, that's for sure. It's much easier to follow habits. But we are capable, so capable of doing more than that. We are capable of changing our worldview. We are capable of developing genuine happiness. We are capable of benefiting not just ourselves, but all human beings, all sentient beings without exception. It's possible. We're more than capable of getting up at this moment and walking this path fully. We're capable of it. We choose to do other things because life gets in the way. It's difficult, of course, but we could do it. What we need to be sure internally is that that's true. We need to know that we can do this. And the attitude of depression will work against that. The attitude of poor me, that will work against that. The attitude is, well, that's okay, but nobody had my upbringing. Nobody sees that. I'm permanently damaged by this. I can't do this. You don't need that. You don't need, well, it's been okay for now, but in the future, I have so many negative things going to happen. I couldn't possibly do this. I can't. I tell you what, though, what I'm going to do is I'm going to wait till I retire. You see, when I retire, well, first of all, people tend to say, I'm going to do this, but unfortunately, I have to work really hard and get my career right. But I'll wait until I'm married and my kids. No, I can't do that now. I'll wait till my kids are grown up. Yeah. When they're grown up and out of the nest, then it's going to be, I'm going to have so much time. So that happens. And you think, yeah, well, I thought I would, but I'm now dealing with grandchildren. And my career is kind of a bit difficult. When I'm retired, so much time I'm going to have. Oh, it's amazing. Then you retire. Yeah, but as soon as I get, before you know it, you're on your deathbed going, where did the time go? So with perfect human rebirth, what you really need to do is to know that you can do it starting now. It's not saying you should do it. It's not saying that all these other things are not important. It's saying that you have a choice. You can do it if you want to. So I'd like you to get into groups now. And I'd like you to think of this one question, only 10 minutes, but this one question. What resources do you have now, internal, external, that allows you to walk this path? What resources do you have, internal and external, to make this human life not just precious, perfect, the Dharma? What would you identify? So thank you. Did you find that an easy exercise, straightforward, or not? In between both. Okay. When I've done this before, a lot of the resources that people think they have and don't have, correct me if I'm wrong, if this is not your experience, but it tends to be quite, you start kind of general, sort of everyday type of resources. do I have enough money? If you don't have enough money to do stuff, I mean, you're stuck, aren't you? I mean, do I have enough income? Not do I have a load of income, but do I have enough to do this? Things like, am I supported by family and friends? Do I have family? Because if you've got, even if you've just got one member of the family, even if you've only got one good friend, this is a huge resource. Someone that will support you, you know, fantastic. Do I have enough time? I mean, we say we're time poor, but, you know, it depends what you spend your time on, eh? Really. So, you know, realistically, do I have enough time? People think like that. Do I have the intellectual curiosity? We have to understand, not everybody does. Not everybody. This will bore people to death. They could be in here and just going, oh my God, will she ever stop? You know what? This is possible. This is possible. A lot of people don't have. It could just be me, of course. I don't know. But a lot of people, it has been said, I'm just saying. But some people don't have that type of intellectual curiosity. They have the curiosity in relation to their family and their friends and their hobbies, especially their hobbies, and where they work. Intellectual curiosity outside of that, they maybe no capacity for it. And they're happy enough. So what you have, so generally speaking, that's, you know, you look at that. And what you're trying to say is, it's not that I have too much, or it's not what I think, or compared to people in the East, I'm very rich. No, please, just like this. Do I have enough to walk this path? Do I have enough? Are there, even if I don't think I have, are there changes I could make relatively easily that would make sure that I have enough to walk this path? That's really where you're going with this. So from a general point of view, this is important. This is very important. And it is recognized in Dharma. But resources from a Buddhist point of view is looking at something slightly different. Okay, it's looking at all of that, of course. All of that, from a Buddhist point of view, is useless. Useless, unless you have what's called the 8 freedoms and the 10 endowments. So here we have yet another list, which you will find on page 7. Don't look now. But in your time, have a good look. It gives it here. So what you're looking at here is that you have the resource because you're born as a human. There are many other states that you could have been born into that are not human. And I don't care how much you love your dog or your cat. They can't do this. They can't do this. So being born human and not being born in other states, you'll read about that. It's very clear. If you're born into a tolerant religious country, this is not easy. You look around the world, how many countries really are that tolerant of something like Dharma, Buddha Dharma? There's many countries you could have been born as a human being in, and I mean, it could be death. I mean, this is not it's not an exaggeration. So being born in a country that has religious tolerance to whatever degree, that's precious. That's very precious. If you have a functioning body and mind, just a functioning body and mind, very, very precious. This is a real freedom. It's not saying that people who have got something wrong with them or who are missing a sense is somehow negative. No. But if you don't have perfect, you know, adequate functioning senses, how are you going to study Dharma? If you don't have adequately functioning body, how are you going to learn to work, to get the money, to study, to have that kind of freedom? So if you, I mean, it's not that people can't do it. Of course they do. I saw people in Copan in wheelchairs. How they got up that mountain is still a complete mystery to me. But they did it. So it's not that people can't do it, it just makes it more difficult. So if you are already have a reasonably functioning body and mind, you're quids in. You're also looking at the fact that you haven't committed what the Dharma calls five heinous crimes. These are the type of crimes and negativities you create that the immediate effect is so immediate and so horrendous on the mind stream, be very difficult to study Dharma. And you've probably heard of these, and that's, you know, killing your mother or father in this lifetime. You know, very difficult. If you've shed the blood of an arhat or a Buddha, if you have been in a religious community and you've caused a schism in that community, now, you want to be careful about this schism. People use that to say, oh, you've caused disharmony in this sangha, so you've created one of them. No, you didn't. You were just being human, stupidly human, but human nonetheless. There is a very, very strict criteria for causing a schism in a sangha community. So be careful. People will throw stuff like that at you. So you have these heinous crimes. If you've committed it in this lifetime, very difficult. If you're free from that in this lifetime, and I have to say, having worked in prisons, this can be very difficult for some prisoners to hear. Because whereas other people I know were in prisons got, sort of shoplifters, and I got heroin addicts and people who've murdered people, they seem to gravitate towards me. I think that says what something, eh? Says something about me. Anyway. But I always got, you know, it was very hard. So they'd look at you and go, well, what if you've killed your best friend who really helped you? I said, it's not going to be helpful, dear, is it? You know, but then you've got to somehow nugget, get them out of that to where they can have some improvement. But if you're sitting here and you have not committed any of these, then you're quids in. The other endowments are that you have faith, and we're going to go into what faith means. You have trust in the Dharma. You've listened to it. You may not want to adopt it up, but something tells you that this is trustworthy. Having trust in the Dharma. Living in a time where a Buddha has appeared. There are times, eons on eons, where there is no Buddha, where there's no Buddha Dharma. The word doesn't exist. Remember, the Buddha talked about many, many eons of existence, the rising and falling of eons. Being born in different planets, the Buddha identified, he talked about all the different planets. He said there are many world systems, many of them without a Buddha Dharma. No Buddha has appeared, but you're living in a system where the Buddha has appeared and has taught. So that's an endowment which is very rare. On top of that, having communities around the world that can support you in your Dharma practice. If you're practicing alone, right, in the world, most people looking at what you do, going off to do meditation, studying this, that, and the next thing, not retaliating, you know, living a kind of a positive life, they might think you're completely crazy. Or you're a soft touch. She's just a soft touch. She can't stand up for herself. This type of thing. But you don't have that. You've got communities dotted all around this country with like-minded people. They might practice a little bit differently, but like-minded people who can support you in the Dharma. This is an endowment which is extremely rare, worth having. And so when you read these freedoms and endowments, think of it that way. Think of it that way. If it worries you about all the different realms of existence, personally, I have no trouble with that because, as Venus said once before, it's experience to mind. But if it is a bit iffy for you, basically, just rejoice in the fact you are human. Because if you weren't, this would be very difficult. So we're going to finish this with a meditation. Okay, so please relax the body, bring the mind inward. Just for the last 15 minutes, let's consider this precious, this perfect human rebirth. You've been considering and talking about why this perfect human rebirth is so precious to you. To what level Do you personally appreciate that? Being honest with yourself, how much do you appreciate that? Do I recognize the potential that I actually have? Do I recognize the latent wisdom I already have? And the loving kindness that accompanies it? Is it possible that often, though, I'm not aware of it, not really? Is my perfect human rebirth clouded by depression? Do I cling to it? What about low self-esteem? Does that play a part? How much do I dwell on past harms that I've perhaps done to others or others have done to me? All of this clouds your perfect human rebirth. It clouds your potential. Occasional unfairness feeling, there's nothing wrong with that. But give it inappropriate attention, you have a problem. Occasionally we all think, poor me, you know, it's human. But give it inappropriate attention, we have a problem. To exaggerate it or to identify it with concretely, problem. When these difficulties arise, and they do, who do you turn to? Often it's to friends and family. Why not? And while friends and family can help you in certain ways, they're in the same boat as you. Lots of frustration turning only to friends and family. Can I see that I already have all I need for genuine happiness to develop within my own mind stream? I have Buddha nature. It's a potential waiting to be developed. No one will give you this. You have it. Just develop it. All my life, I know I can access and understand things, and I can experience my mind. But how much can I apply discriminating wisdom to my actions? And having applied discriminating wisdom, can I make that my habit? Do I have the confidence to do the groundwork here within the Lam Rim to avoid frustration, see myself clearly, my positive qualities and my negative qualities, decide what is good, develop that, and eliminate any negative qualities? If you can do this, you have a perfect human rebirth. We don't let ourselves have a problem of being trivial, caught up by projections, by concrete ideas of phenomena and self. But it's a hard habit to break. Our habit is to get caught up in these projections, inflate them. But the result is only depression, a kind of hopelessness, a kind of self-created pity. Is that true? Examine. Maybe that's not true for you. Examine it. Understanding the perfect human rebirth is an antidote to all this. You recognize, you rejoice in your good fortune. You identify your unique potential. Give yourself a revised enthusiasm for this lifetime, this perfect lifetime. Embedded in an increasing concern for others, an increasing compassion for others. And you can do this anytime. This particular practice, meditation on precious human rebirth, is especially good in the evening, especially good to settling down to sleep. And when you've acknowledged that perfect human rebirth that you have, then perhaps going to sleep, not just acknowledging this, but just gently considering, if I could offer human beings that which would make their life perfect human rebirth, what would it be? I wonder what I could offer to human beings whose life is not perfect human rebirth. But perhaps my actions could make it a perfect human rebirth. What would those actions be? What could I bring to the world? And for the last few minutes, consider this. Whatever you would give others to make it perfect, you have already given this to yourself in a previous lifetime. Otherwise, you would not be here. You have given it already to yourself. You have all it needs. Thank you. So I'm going to leave you now, and here's what I'd like you to do. Spend the last 5 minutes looking at the list and the ideas from page 7 on precious human rebirth. When you've finished, give it 5 minutes or so. See if it accords with anything you've been thinking about. Then do an individual dedication. Do it silently within yourself before you leave. And I'll see you at 2:15. Thank you very much for this morning.